to the fourth case, the United States versus Smith.
Boy, I've really emptied the courtroom. May it please the court all the same.
We won't interpret that as a reflection on your great capabilities in that.
Thank you. I speak today on behalf of Anthony Smith. This is a small case, but systemically it raises, I think, a potentially large question, and that is who in our federal system prosecutes federal crimes and in federal court and speaks in the name of the people of the United States.
Speaking of a large question, as a practical matter, if you're right, how many faulty indictments have been issued in drug cases and trigger lock cases and all these things all around the country? Is this how it's always done?
In recent years, I think I can't speak to trigger lock because I know in our district, special assistant U.S. attorneys from DA's offices didn't come along until ceasefire. The precursor of that was Project Exile, which I think began in Richmond in 1994. The answer would be hundreds, all of them waived. I think until. I'm not aware of any other district in which lawyers have pursued
that. Your argument is that this is a jurisdictional defect, not subject to harmless error.
Yes. Now, whether that potentially could unravel a number of convictions that have, been affirmed and are final, I don't know. I know in our district, the special assistant U.S. attorneys appear to be disappearing. I think the last under this particular framework is set to leave the office in May or June, if I understand the United States Attorney's Office intentions correctly. But we've had two or three of these folks, or maybe as many as four, for the last. It extends back into the late Clinton administration.
I think they've argued before the court. Not only
yes. Oh, I know they have.
Not only the travel, but I've
yes, yes. No, I know that's true because I've been down here when that's been true. The track of my argument, which really is statutory, is pretty straightforward.
But I wanted to start at the other end of your argument.
Sure.
Because it seems to me. Even if you're right about the designation statute, and I have serious doubts about that, but if you were, the Supreme Court's decision in Mechanic would suggest to us that this is, in fact, subject to harmless error analysis. And, in fact, because the Pettit jury convicted, what the grand jury had to say about probable cause or not is no longer of any moment. That's just probable cause, and we now have a finding of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I also have to say, it's surprising to me that in your analysis of potential prejudice, you speak only about the fact that it's Mr. Phillips standing there in the room, and you don't say a word about what evidence was before the grand jury. The grand jury may have had abundant evidence in front of it that would have caused it to return an indictment. If Santa Claus was standing there, if anybody was there.
I can't say a word about the evidence. I've never seen a word of it. None of it ever was disclosed here.
Well, and it typically wouldn't be, but the fact is grand juries do have evidence put in front of them. The district court would have access to reviewing that
right.
Under seal. I mean, it's not like
no,
it's not secret in that sense.
No, so this court can presume and should presume that there was some evidence offered here. To address Your Honor's question, to get to Mechanic, the court would have to set aside Judge Evans' concern and would have to find that this is not a jurisdictional.
I don't think Judge
that
Evans
my
was
concern.
Saying that.
Okay,
it
well,
he was saying if it were, if how many 2255s are going to be?
The hypothetical concern that Judge Evans raised, if the court were past that, it would get to Mechanic. And I've argued on the brief, and I you know, and I will elaborate that, you know, the error in mechanic raised only after conviction was tandem witnesses at one juncture of the grand jury investigation. Here the error appears to have been an unauthorized attorney, if one accepts my statutory argument, piloting the grand jury investigation from beginning to end. And certainly under Bank of Nova Scotia, which, you know, gives us some guidance on what's harmless in this setting, I think an unauthorized prosecutor alone in the grand jury is more likely substantially to affect the grand jury's decision whether to indict, or at least to raise a grave doubt about that. I mean, this is...
I thought it was a stretch from Bank of Nova Scotia, too, though. I mean, this man is a state employee. He's not a private lawyer like the 19th century
yes.
problems that you discuss. He's a lawyer. He's
yes.
not, you know, a non-lawyer.
That's true.
Appearing before
he's a good
grand
lawyer.
Jury. Right. No, we're not talking about Mr. Phillips.
No, I understand.
I'm sure he is a good lawyer. But in any event, we know some structural facts, if you can call
right.
it that, about
yes.
him. And so I'm not even sure Bank of Nova Scotia, there's such a tiny scope the Supreme Court has given us for structural error, particularly in recent years, and particularly in finding indictment defects to be jurisdictional or not. The court is not moving
well,
in that direction.
And I don't know that I would use the term structural error here, since it's a term of art. Bank of Nova Scotia speaks of fundamental error, and asks whether this substantially affected the decision to indict or raises grave doubt that it did. And my point is there's no gainsaying the fact that the U.S. attorneys have substantial control over grand juries. And
everything Phillips did was under the control of the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, according to his appointment letter. He couldn't decide
yes.
that he was going to bring this case or walk into the grand jury room or do anything else without proper authorization
mm-hmm.
from the U.S. attorney.
That's what the appointment letter says.
Right. Well, is there any reason to believe that that's phony?
No. And I mean, the argument, though, is that, you know, that there's a problem, a lack of authorization before we even get there. Section 547 says that except as otherwise provided by law, the United States attorney shall prosecute criminal cases in his or her district. 543 allows the Attorney General to appoint special assistant United States attorneys.
And it doesn't, unlike some statutes. I mean, for example, federal judges, a topic near and dear to our hearts, have very specific regulations about what kind of outside income we're entitled
yes.
to have. And I don't see anything in 543 that indicates that the people the Attorney General appoints, as long as he stays within the ceiling that the statute provides, are not entitled to have income from another source. If there were such a rule, then the rule you're arguing
well,
for...
And I have assumed for the sake of argument, I have assumed for the sake of argument that people could have incidental outside income.
What if it's half and half? That's not incidental.
Well, I think the question is, where is the source of your salary for doing this work in the United States Attorney's Office? Because when we get to 548, it provides that the Attorney General shall fix the salary of United States attorneys, assistant United States attorneys, and special assistants. So if the construction is to permit the Attorney General to say there'll be no compensation, but someone else to pay the salary for doing that work in the U.S. Attorney's Office, then that holding under 548 is as good for the United States attorney as it is for any special assistant U.S. attorney. I think that would be tantamount to reading 548 to approve the Attorney General appointing the United States attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, setting her compensation at zero, and saying, I'm going to let Kirkland and Ellis, or the Cook County
well,
State's
how about
attorney,
this?
Pay you.
Is the implication of your position that the U.S. Attorney's offices cannot appoint third-year law students as externs for compensation of zero and get them authorized under the relevant bar rules to appear in court?
They certainly couldn't appear in the grand jury.
Why is the grand jury any different from appearing in court and handling a trial if they have you know, most states, Illinois certainly does, I think Wisconsin does too, have these third-year law students.
They would not fall within the definition of an attorney for the government as a third-year law student.
They do. They've argued here. They are attorneys for the government, and they have the correct authorization. So it sounds to me like your rule precludes that, too.
It is closer to sort of like nationalizing the Guard or something. Federalizing, excuse me.
I'm sorry?
It is closer to like federalizing the Guard, where the Guard, the Guardsman comes under, in certain circumstances, the direction of the Department of Defense rather than a governor, but the Guardsmen also, they have income.
And that takes us to Title V. And the distinction between an appointment and being on detail. I think guardsmen probably are on detail, in which case we do presume that the state pays. This clearly was an appointment, which entitled the appointee to pay under federal pay scales and made the appointee a federal employee for all but pension and health insurance kind of purposes. My time has elapsed, but
I think this
really is clearly an appointment, and Title V becomes pretty important there and distinguishes, I think, the National Guardsmen. So what I'm asking in the prayer for relief is important here, because I think even if there was a lack of jurisdiction, this would be a vacate and dismiss without prejudice. I don't think there's a double jeopardy bar here, although the briefs really didn't address that.
Do you want a minute on Batson?
Unless there are questions on Batson, I'll stand on brief. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, James Froling.
May it please the Court, my name is Rick Froling. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. I represent the United States in this matter. This Court should affirm the District Court's decisions and affirm Mr. Smith's conviction. Because the Batson issue wasn't addressed today, I'll rest on the briefs on that as well, unless the Court has questions. Regarding the Special Assistant U.S. Attorney issue, we'd just like to raise a couple of issues or answer a couple of questions that came up today. Lastly, there was just some discussion about whether Title V is important. And just to be clear, we're not arguing that Mr. Phillips was appointed or was on detail under Title V, Section 3372. The reference was simply to counter the policy argument that there's something inherently wrong about the state paying people who are working for federal agencies, federal employees. And the context is, well, Congress has seen that in another context, the detail situation, and didn't find a problem with it. There had been some discussion about the harmless error standard, and Judge Wood asked some questions about Bank of Nova Scotia. It's kind of an interesting situation. It's a glass half full, glass half empty sort of situation. We see Bank of Nova Scotia as saying errors which in the grand jury process, which after trial, unless you can show prejudice, they're harmless. The defense sees that as, hey, there are situations where we can show prejudice and you can dismiss the indictment after trial. The bottom line here is a trial jury found Mr. Smith guilty. It was a properly impaneled grand jury. The indictment was clear on its face. It was signed by the U.S. attorney. The trial occurred, and he was found guilty. Any error was harmless, but for the reasons set forth in the brief, we don't think there was an error in the first place. Mr. Phillips was properly appointed and properly authorized to be in front of the grand jury.
Does the Department of Justice want to take the position in this court about that it's harmless? I ask that against the backdrop of the extensive use, relatively extensive use of these specials.
Sure. You only get there if you find an error, and we submit there's no error here. In the particular context of Mr. Smith's convictions and the factual situations, I think the conclusion is that it's harmless. But
we found it harmless. I suppose you'd speak to the solicitor, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that would probably be the case. I'd better. If not, I'd be in trouble for inadequate supervision, and then we'd probably raise a whole other group of issues. And that seems to be the bottom line here, was kind of a supervision-based argument that there wasn't control by the Attorney General, and he's not here complaining. It's Mr. Smith complaining on his behalf that there might not have been supervision, but that's not what the record here shows.
Is your position that there's never any kind of implicit conflict of interest if the state is paying the salary of a special assistant U.S. attorney? For instance, if here in the Northern District of Illinois there were some people on detail and U.S. attorney decided to put them on the licenses for bribes case or some of the other perhaps sensitive prosecutions that implicate state government?
Sure, there could be a conflict situation in that instance. I'm not saying it's going to be a perfect situation in every case, but under the facts here.
Well, but if we're speaking, though, structurally, if it could matter that the state is paying the salary, because that, I assume, that would be not because anybody wasn't displaying integrity, it's just sort of structural conflict, then would we be hasty to say that it's always all right for the Attorney General to say zero is what you earn as long as you're under the supervision of the U.S. Attorney?
I think it's okay to say that under the statutes that have been raised here, under 548, 543, for example. It may be another issue of whether there's a violation of the conflict of interest provisions or ethics provisions under Title V. There might be an issue, but that's not what we're dealing with here. Simply compensation is the issue. I don't think that would be a problem from that standpoint. There certainly would be problems with conflict of interest, things which would have to be addressed, but that's not what we're dealing with here. So I don't think under 548, the compensation statute, that that would be a specific problem, even in that instance. Unless there are further questions, we'd simply ask that the court affirm.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under